Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
You've made a lot about, well, not a lot, but that is not the original concept of what Epcot meant. And I think it would have evolved at this very definitely. I can't see how he would have done it any differently, because everything I see here reminds me of him standing in the American Adventure and that wonderful vocal group singing there. All of a sudden, I got this image of Dad, and he was a great sentimentalist. You know, he would watch the flag lowering at Disneyland every evening they were down there, and tears would go down his cheeks, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I could see, I had an image of him standing there listening to this group with tears coming down his cheeks. I know he would have been there doing that, and this is all so much in character of his curiosity and excitement about everything, the future, and yet history and the world, Europe.
But the thing that is so wonderful is because he had this vision before he died, and it's been carried on so completely. That's what would make him feel very good. He used to, when we'd go out to eat, he'd take a paper napkin and he'd tell me about, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, and have all these countries come in, and it's happened, which I think is wonderful.
Hello and welcome to Ink and Paint Inbetweeners, our series of bonus episodes expanding on the story of the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. In these short bonus episodes, we're sharing history and stories related to the Disney animated classics that sit just outside of the films themselves and complement our main Ink and Paint episodes. In this episode, we're taking a look at one of the strangest of Walt Disney's personal projects, his utopian city of the future, Epcot. In the mid-1950s, Walt Disney had conquered two major fields of popular entertainment: the theme park with his revolutionary Disneyland, and television with its companion series. Despite financial issues with the animated feature films and lackluster critical reception for the live-action films, these two achievements solidified Walt Disney Productions and its subsidiaries as amongst the most powerful forces in the entertainment industry, and Walt Disney as a pioneering American icon. In the early days of Disneyland, Walt would visit the park often, assessing every detail to make sure his magical kingdom retained his high standard. Very quickly, though, his interest in the park began to wane. The same thing had happened with animation after the gargantuan success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. For Walt, the joy was in the challenge, working day and night to achieve an impossible goal. His fire and energy came from creation, ideas, imagining, perfecting, reaching beyond what had been done before. When the impossible was achieved, as had been done with Snow White and Disneyland, there was very little left in these enterprises for him to be excited about. With the success of Disneyland, the question was raised whether Disney would open a second theme park. The company supported the idea, especially when Disneyland's major geographical issue was taken into account. It was easily accessible for those on the west coast of the United States, but in this early period in the development of the family vacation, an expensive option for those on the east coast. Perhaps a new theme park on the opposite end of the continent might work in their favor. Walt wasn't interested in repeating himself. He had other ideas in mind, something even more radical. He had revolutionized how people would be entertained. He now wanted to revolutionize how people lived. In the late 1950s, a number of Los Angeles' cultural institutions were facing financial crisis. Both the Chouinard Art Institute and the Los Angeles Conservatory of Music were on the edge of bankruptcy, and Chouinard's founder, Nelbert Chouinard, was now too frail to fight for the school. She turned to Walt Disney for assistance, the Chouinard Institute having worked closely with Walt Disney Productions since the 1930s. Along with Lulu May von Hagen, the chair of the Los Angeles Conservatory, Walt proposed merging the two institutions into a single entity, a major institute for the arts. The new facility, dubbed the California Institute of the Arts, was formed in 1961, with Walt spearheading the merger and development. His vision for the school was to build an artistic community where artists of all different fields could study, work, and collaborate. While music and art were the first areas to be covered, the plan was to eventually build them with studies in dance, performance, and other areas of the arts. Walt's dreams even went a few steps beyond. The arts had never been a financially viable pursuit, putting enormous strain on the artists themselves to pay for food and accommodation. He envisaged Cal Arts becoming a kind of city of the arts, where students and staff would not only study and work, but live as an artistic community. At the premiere of Mary Poppins in 1964, Walt used the event to further publicize Cal Arts. Before the film, he and Lulu Van Hagen introduced a short film on the Institute, its history, and its plans, called The Cal Arts Story, narrated by Sebastian Cabot.
Cal Arts will be dedicated to the future, in the knowledge that man's greatest achievements have occurred at those moments in history when all the arts flourished together, nourishing one another by some mysterious cross-fertilization of ideas and techniques. Southern California now possesses the finest of music centers, galleries, theaters, museums, treasure houses in which to preserve our heritage. Our treasure is talent, a natural resource as valuable as diamonds, as precious as rubies. Only the finest of talents will serve our bright new temples and make them fulfill their purpose. They must know only the best. Cal Arts will provide that best, will serve and enrich not only our city and our community, but our nation and the world. For Cal Arts is conceived in the philosophy that Southern California is, and will be for generations to come, the cultural center of the new age.
The new Cal Arts campus would not break ground until 1969, 3 years after Walt's death. But the idea of an artist's city may have been the first stirrings of an even more ambitious idea, where his concerns around urban planning would collide with his fascination with future technology and the all-consuming perfectionism of Disneyland. With many cities in the United States growing beyond their initial scale, a solution to urban planning challenges was in dire need. More people meant a greater need for public transportation, waste management, and municipal resources. For the more conservative-minded and predominantly white American citizens, there was also concerns around the presence of non-white communities moving into the affluent suburbs, destabilizing a deeply racist urban and cultural divide that white Americans had grown accustomed to. In the development of Disneyland, the movement of visitors and accessibility to amenities had been a primary concern, with even the rubbish bins designed to Walt's exacting standards. It makes sense, then, that he would start to develop these ideas further, applying the same level of scrutiny to the idea of what a fully-fledged city might look like in the future. Walt was always fascinated by what the future might hold, and actively began collaborating with engineers and scientists to conceptualize it. Some of these ideas had already been explored in the Tomorrowland section of Disneyland, including a House of the Future sponsored by Monsanto that opened in the park in 1957. For the New York World's Fair in 1964 and 1965, Walt presented displays utilizing the auto-animatronics technology that had begun development during the creation of Disneyland. This technology is now closely associated with animatronic figures at the theme parks, especially the Hall of Presidents at Walt Disney World. But for the World's Fair, the technology was used for Progress Land, a display sponsored by General Electric. Audiences sat in a revolving auditorium to watch the Carousel of Progress, where auto-animatronics demonstrated the future of electricity in the home. For the presentation, the Sherman Brothers composed the song, There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow.
In Act One, the audience meets an audio-animatronic family. The time is just before the turn of the century. Father, the host, tells the joys of living in the pre-electric era. Next, our audience moves to Act Two and the 1920s. Now the family has all kinds of new contraptions to make life more enjoyable, including a crystal radio. Then our audience moves to the fabulous 40s, the beginning of the electronic era and the age of television. The last act of the Carousel Theater shows the wonderful family life of today with its leisurely push-button living.
After the World's Fair, the Carousel of Progress found a new home at Walt Disney World. Around the same time as the presentation at the World's Fair, Disney began secretly looking for a location to build an East Coast version of Disneyland. Surveys were done without public knowledge, with a site in Orlando, Florida, eventually chosen. Disney announced their intentions to build the park on November 15, 1965, with plans to open in early 1969. There was a tremendous amount of excitement around the announcement, but one person who had little enthusiasm for the idea was Walt himself. He wasn't interested in repeating the Disneyland project, and only agreed to the plans if he could attach an idea of his own to the sprawling complex. He had continued to mull over his old idea of an artist city, moving away from it as an artistically driven community towards a technologically driven one. With the building of Disneyland, he'd also grown an interest in urban planning and architecture, and was intrigued by the challenge of solving the issues that plagued the major cities in the United States. Walt was intrigued with solving the problem of a central commercialized area and a residential area coexisting, recalled Imagineer Marvin Davis, and making the whole thing work for the moving of people and traffic in and out. These were major challenges to solve, and not easily achievable, but what Walt was interested in was not an immediate solution, but a means to get there. The new park, Disney World, would be the means by which he would attempt his most ambitious idea yet, an experimental city attached to the park for employees to live, designed and planned by the man himself to be the perfect residential environment. Walt named his experimental city Epcot, standing for Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. The site would be attached to Disney World, but rather than an attraction, it would be a thriving community where residents would have access to the latest experimental technologies. To achieve this, Walt would collaborate with pioneering companies such as General Electric, Westinghouse, and RCA. Walt had initially approached acclaimed architect Welton Becket to design Epcot, but was unhappy with his presentation. Instead, the artists and engineers at WED, who had designed Disneyland and who would design Disney World, were put to the task, trying to make sense of Walt's wild ideas. The city would cover 5,000 hectares, arranged in a wheel shape 3 miles in diameter. Amenities such as roads and garbage disposal would be underneath the city itself, so as not to disrupt its aesthetics or the movement of the population. "It's like a city of tomorrow ought to be," Walt said to the Chicago Tribune in September 1966. "It will be a controlled community, a showcase for American industry and research, schools, cultural and educational opportunities. There'll be no slum areas because we won't let them develop. There will be no landowners. People will rent homes instead of buying them. Everyone will be employed. One of our requirements is that the people who live in Epcot must keep it alive." Walt's conceit sounded like a kind of futuristic utopia, but it wasn't without its drawbacks. While residents would be able to enjoy these luxuries and amenities, ownership of everything within Epcot would still reside with Walt and his company, where any technology could be replaced with new experimental alternatives without needing to ask permission from the residents. There was even discussion at one point of tenants being on a constant rotation, only occupying property in Epcot for no more than a few decades. This would deny them any permanent voting rights, making Walt the sole legislative power. If he was going to conceive his wonder of the future, he didn't want anyone getting in the way of his plans. The idea of Epcot now sounds like something from a science fiction novel, but in the final years of his life, Walt was determined to make it a reality. Part of the land purchased for Disney World was set aside for the city, expected by Walt to house up to 60,000 residents by the end of the century. There would be state-of-the-art facilities for education and entertainment, a teen center to counter juvenile delinquency, houses for worship, and aged care residences. There would not be a single aspect of modern life not scrutinized and perfected. In order to convince potential industry partners and the Florida legislature, Walt explained his plans for Disney World, and in particular Epcot, in a short film directed by Hamilton Lusk. Shot on October 27, 1966, it shows Walt standing in front of towering plans and maps of the city, outlining how it will connect to the park and to the wider Florida community. "Everything in this room will change time and time again as we move forward," he said. "But the basic philosophy of what we're planning for Disney World is going to remain very much as it is right now."
And now, where do we go from these preliminary plans and sketches? Well, a project like this is so vast in scope that no one company alone can make it a reality. But if we can bring together the technical know-how of American industry and the creative imagination of the Disney organization, I'm confident we can create right here in Disney World a showcase to the world of the American free enterprise system. I believe we can build a community that more people will talk about and come to look at than any other area in the world. And with your cooperation, I'm sure this experimental prototype community of tomorrow can influence the future of city living for generations to come. It's an exciting challenge, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for everyone who participates. Speaking for myself and the entire Disney organization, we're ready to go right now.
I vividly remember, recalled Imagineer Bob Gurr, sitting next to Walt on a plane where he pointed to the center of Epcot, an oval-shaped area. Walt said, "When this Epcot gets up and running and we have all the participants there, this spot with a little bench is where Lily and I are going to sit and watch." Unfortunately, Walt wouldn't live to see his dream become a reality. Only 2 months after the promotional film was shot, Walt passed away at the age of 65. His dying wish to his brother Roy was that his plans for Epcot would not be abandoned, and that his dream city of the future would be realized. After Walt's death, Roy decided to cancel development on Epcot, focusing instead on completing the theme park component of the Florida project, christened Walt Disney World in honor of his brother. In the 1970s, with Walt Disney World now open and proving a major success, Disney CEO Card Walker floated the idea of revisiting Epcot. There were concerns, however, about the original plans. The Disney board didn't believe that residences would feel comfortable having their every move monitored while living in the city, an uncomfortable aspect of Walt's vision of a peaceful and inspiring urban utopia. Instead, the idea for Epcot evolved from a city into a theme park attraction as part of Walt Disney World, a permanent fixture akin to the World's Fairs. On October 1, 1982, the Epcot Center opened at Walt Disney World, the second of the four theme parks built for the sprawling complex, a celebration of technology and international culture. While Walt's dream of an experimental city of the future would not become a reality, the Epcot Center preserved his belief in and excitement for the future of technology and the betterment of mankind, albeit without an oppressive level of control. On October 24th, Card Walker delivered a dedication to the park, recalling the words Walt had used in the dedication of Disneyland in 1955. "To all who come to this place of joy, hope, and friendship, welcome. Epcot is inspired by Walt Disney's creative vision. Here, human achievements are celebrated through imagination, wonders of enterprise and concepts of the future that promise new and exciting benefits for all."
Our goals for Epcot Center are quite clear. We want to first entertain, then inform and inspire all who come here, and above all, to instill in our guests a new sense of belief and pride in mankind's ability to shape a world that offers real hope to people everywhere in the world. Thank you.
Even through research, it's been hard for me to get my head around exactly what the Epcot Center is. So joining me on this in-betweener is a guest who has not only visited Epcot, but has worked there. Joining me is co-presenter of the tremendous LGBTIQ+ themed music podcast, Oral Fixation, Andrew Gott. Andy, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thank you for having me, Daniel. Long time listener, first time guest.
Tell us a bit about Oral Fixation. What is the idea behind the podcast? Where did it come from?
The podcast is about 2.5 years old now, and it was born out of various things which were going on in my life and my co-presenter Drew's life, basically on my end, creative frustration. And Drew and I were talking about, one, an outlet for those frustrations, but two, we're so passionate about music, nauseatingly so. We both are queer individuals and we revere queer culture and unpacking it and figuring out why things are queer. So we just merged our two interests, and each episode revolves around dissecting either an artist or a particular album which might be loved by queer people or made by a queer artist or have some kind of significance in modern queer culture. So usually our episodes are quite straightforward, an artist or an album, but every now and then we like to do special one-off episodes. What do you call in Compaint an in-betweener?
In-betweeners, yes, yes.
Yeah, so that's how we met, Daniel, because you joined us on Oral Fixation's equivalent in-betweener about 9 episodes ago now. And thrillingly, it's been really well received.
Yes, I was very impressed and surprised that people were interested in the ramblings of a, you know, Melbourne-based madman about Howard Ashman for however long I talked for.
Yeah, and that was also kind of a step further into merging another huge passion of mine, which is, of course, is Disney, but specifically the music and the films which Howard Ashman had creative input with. So The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, parts of Aladdin, and why that was a really important LGBTIAQ plus queer part of Disney's culture and history. I mean, it was a story that needed to be told.
And why do you think, I mean, I imagine this is a question you've kind of been asked already in regards to the podcast, and certainly seems to be, from having listened to the podcast, seems to be like the continual question and investigation of it. But why do you think music is so important to LGBTIQ plus culture? Why is it that music is something that we're drawn to? Why is it something that inspires us? I mean, that's obviously, it's a big, you know, music has an impact on every human being that, you know, comes into contact with it. But why is it particularly important for our community?
Well, first of all, enormous concept to unpack, but a very interesting one at that, because I don't know, it's difficult to say something which generalizes too much or maybe plays into a stereotype, but maybe just personally speaking, I feel like as a queer person, I've always loved for cultural artifacts which speak to me or light something up in me where maybe I didn't realize it at the time, but on reflection with hindsight, maybe I felt seen by that song, film, book, character, artist in some way. Maybe the characters that as young queer children, even before we know that we're queer, we gravitate towards are displaying qualities of strength or pride or power. Or, I don't know, the very nature of queerness to me, which is constantly evolving, and there's so many equally valid opinions and interpretations of it. But for me, I interpret queerness as the othered, not the mainstream group or society of people, and the people who gravitate towards those who feel a little bit different from everyone else. And, you know, absolutely not in a negative way. You know, there's power and magic in pride, in forming those clans or finding those tribes of people who are like you, but you're not really like a lot of other people. I'm getting a bit abstract there, but I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it does. And I mean, you know, one of the things that's so incredible about music as an art form is the fact that it is inherently open and inherently generous, and it's kind of it's emotionally driven, and it's about kind of open emotion. And so much about being a queer person is about navigating the fact that, you know, in the way that society is set up, we're not always allowed to be open and expressive. And maybe that's a reason why, kind of bouncing off what you were saying, like why music does connect so deeply with the queer community, is the sense of music is a means through which you can be open. It's a socially acceptable art form in which openness and emotionality is inherent and vital to its function, which means, like, you know a lot of the music that we're drawn to is music that is quite joyous, music that is quite energetic, music that has a sense of pride and joy to it. That maybe that's another reason why music is something that's so important to us.
Absolutely. And when I think about the topics that we touched on in our Howard Ashman episode about those specific 3 films, the consistent, the kind of the core theme, which I keep coming back to as to why, okay, here's a stereotype, but it's kind of true. Why do gay men love Ariel? Like, what is it about gays and mermaids, really? But there's something about Ariel when she's straddling that rock and that fabulous flaming red hair is flying behind her and she's got a fabulous purple bra. Yes, okay, she's iconic, but she wants to be part of that world. Belle wants much more than this provincial life. Those fabulous heroines. Jasmine wants to escape that palace and fly off with a really handsome guy on a magic carpet. The queer experience, hello. But also, in all seriousness, those three films, because, you know, we know what Howard Ashman's upbringing and life was like, the heroines are fabulous individuals who want more with their life. They don't want the lot that they were given. They want to seek adventure and find the excitement and find people like them. And that is generally a universal human experience. It's not just queer people who love Ariel. You know, anyone and everyone loves Ariel, but it's also a profound feeling that queer people can relate to, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that gives me a nice way to segue into asking my next question. Do you remember what the very first Disney animated film was that you saw?
I really do think it was Beauty and the Beast. When I was kind of trying to articulate and find, you know, cultural language to converse with people, you know, when I'm like 16, 17, ultra, super, nauseatingly pretentious, trying to talk about art like I know everything, I would often say to people, you know, there's a real difference between what's the best thing and what's your favorite thing. They're not the same, guys. And a great example of that is we all know that Beauty and the Beast is the best Disney film, but The Little Mermaid's my favorite. And I'd look really satisfied with myself and people would just walk away from me. And that's literally my life, basically. Just trying to come up with something really profound about lowbrow pop culture and not really finding anyone who wants to engage. But I know you'd engage with me, Daniel. You would.
I actually kind of agree with that sentiment, though. I mean, you know, for example, Lord of the Rings is my favorite film, but I don't think it's the best film I've ever seen. I think you can be two separate things, because also something like, you know, a favorite is a thing that is a thing that you connect with emotionally. Like, you know, like as an example, you know, The Lord of the Rings is my favorite film. I think maybe the best film I've ever seen in the Schindler's List, maybe. And that is, you know, that's an incredibly upsetting, impactful, powerful, distressing film, which means it's not a film that I would call one of my favorites. But I mean, you know, it's not a film I go to for comfort, but it's a film that leaves me incredibly impressed and inspired and shaken and all those kind of things. Anyway, that's getting off on topic. But first film, Beauty and the Beast, was it on VHS or was it in the cinema?
It was on beautiful VHS, beautiful plastic VHS. I can envision the case in my hand like it was yesterday. And of course, like many kids our age, I think I had this huge collection with, you know, all of the greats. When I think about on the older films, there does seem to be a bit of a gap in, I feel like Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, those kind of 50s, 60s classics weren't really a part of the collection that I just happened to have access to. It was definitely the 90s stuff. It's crazy when you see the box office takings. Pocahontas was by no means an underdog, but now in the Disney canon, it kind of feels a little bit forgotten about. And there's that amazing story about how all the animators wanted to work on Pocahontas and no one wanted to work on this quirky little thing about a lion in Africa. And then, hello, history happened. But I remember thinking like, oh, Pocahontas, like, you know, it's not the most popular, but I love that film. She's incredible. The music's amazing. And there was always something even within that Disney Renaissance, which drew me to... It's crazy to say the lesser loved ones because they were so popular, but comparatively, it felt like, you know, your Pocahontas's, your Hercules, your Mulans didn't hit the success of the early 90s. But gosh, that like 10 to 12 year period, I mean, you're the expert here. That was just nonstop gold for me.
It's a surprise how many... Pocahontas is a film that has come up as in discussion about favorites and early Disney experiences and important Disney experiences. Pocahontas comes up a lot with the guests that I've spoken to so far. You know, you have the three big hitters of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and then questionably The Lion King. And there is a kind of drop off after that. But I mean, those films also were the films that probably were more accessible to us as we got older. It was easier for us to go to the cinemas by ourselves to go and see those films. It was easier for us to be able to go buy the soundtracks for those films or, you know, buy the merchandise from those films. So I think maybe that's another reason why there's a certain degree of... I wonder about it. I wonder if there's a certain degree of autonomy that comes with the later 90s films that doesn't exist with the early ones because we're all very young and impressionable, you know? Like, I have to have my parents take me to see Beauty and the Beast. I have to have my mum take me to go and see The Lion King. But I can go and see Mulan by myself because I'm a little bit older. How has Disney persisted for you, which is a way to kind of move into talking about our topic for this episode, how has Disney persisted for you into adulthood?
I guess that is a very neat segue into why we're here, Daniel. Disney, as a concept, it's there. I mean, there really isn't another company on the planet which is, on one hand, both this terrifying corporate monster which has its fingers in every pie imaginable and literally prints money, but has had such a deep, profound impact on so many people around the world in like a staggeringly emotional sense. And it's something that as a person who seems to be split down the middle with being really quite cynical a lot of the time, but then incredibly sentimental, and often sometimes at the same time, Disney always poses this question for me as to why I feel so strongly about animated characters or particular songs which were effectively written for children. And as we're about to talk about, what at their crudest form are theme parks, but to me can often be these outstanding examples of the very best of human achievement when a commercial, enormous company has the resources to fund this magical team of creatives and artisans and artists, and they can truly do their very best. And then the company can slap a ticket price on it and we can all go and attend and they can make the money back. But there are these glimpses of where commercialism and art intersect so perfectly in a way that very, very few companies around the world can even come close to. So I would actually, you know, be very proud and count myself as quite a diehard Disney fan. I've spent a lot of money and a vast portion of my life either traveling to Disney theme parks or, you know, getting friends to watch Disney films with me or buying ridiculous merchandise, which thankfully has calmed down as I've turned 30. But I also do have a niece who I can now buy Ariel dolls for as well. I can still kind of remove myself from that. Well, I like to think so, and look at it with a bird's eye view and think, this is kind of crazy that you're so passionate about literally a money printing machine, which plays on your emotions and manipulates them. And I'm like, yes, that is crazy, but hey, manipulate my emotions because it works and I enjoy it.
I mean, that is the great conflict of being fascinated by Disney, is that problem of the fact that it is the intersection of commercialization and capitalism and artistic pursuit, and the degree and the areas of commercialization and capitalism within Disney are at times quite horrifying, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, the degree to which money and power dictate a lot of their decisions. But then you look at it from the artistic perspective, and it's some of the most artistically breathtaking works of the 20th and 21st century, whether that be the Disney animated films or some of the live action films, or yes, the theme parks themselves. I mean, I think you're right that, the theme parks, I've never visited any of them, but only from just reading about them and certainly reading about the philosophies of where they come from, there is such a incredible attention to detail about the idea of a holistic experience, of creating a world an audience can step into. And the artistry means create complete control over every aspect of that world for maximum effect. The flip side, of course, is that that control from an artistic perspective also provides control from a commercial perspective, which borders sometimes on the maniacal. I mean, all of that said, I still can't wait for the world to open up and, to go to Disneyland for the first time and stand there and be like, oh, this is that thing I've been reading about all this time. But I think you hit the nail on the head of that's the conflict that comes with being fascinated by Disney. I mean, it's like even just doing this podcast, I have to buy all this material, all this research material, books and Blu-rays and soundtracks and all this stuff, and it costs a lot of money. And that's fine because it's of really good quality, but I'm also looking at this being like, this is costs a lot of money because this is Disney. And so I'm giving all this money to Disney for this product that probably isn't worth this amount of money, but I really want it because I need it for this thing that I'm doing. Plus also sometimes I just want it because it looks nice on my shelf. And so it's kind of like you have to navigate that philosophy of like, how do I feel about this company that is the great master manipulators of our time that also happen to create great work? Yeah, it's a fascinating conflict to navigate.
And that's a really great time to remind listeners of Income Paint that Daniel's PayPal details are in the episode bio notes of this. And if you
they are not, they are absolutely not. To move on from talking about that, we should probably get on to talking about the topic at hand. So, when we got together to talk about Howard Ashman for Oral Fixation, you and I were talking about possibilities of you being able to come on to Ink and Paint. And a topic that you suggested was to talk about Epcot, which was not on my plan of what to talk about on the podcast. And it was always one of those subjects that I'd read. It was kind of always in the periphery of what I was reading. It was mentioned significantly in Walt's biography. It's mentioned significantly in Disney War, which is about the 80s and 90s and 2000s. It's always been this object that I've kind of vaguely had an understanding of what it was, but not ever dug in deeply. And it seemed like a good opportunity as any for me to learn from you, who are significantly more interested and authoritative on Epcot than I am. Why was Epcot a topic you wanted to talk about?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed your episodes on Disneyland. I think you did two or three, did you not?
Two, yes. Two episodes.
I liked that while the concept of this podcast is focusing on the animated canon, of course, it made complete sense for you to kind of divert for a couple of episodes on what was at that time of, you know, Walt Disney's career and life, the biggest, hugest achievement for him and has effectively created the blueprint for theme parks and immersive experiences throughout the world ever since. Like there was really nothing like Disneyland before it opened. And it seems like, you know, there was that 5-year span where he would kind of play with this incredible toy that he'd built. And he'd really enjoy it and try and tweak and improve it. But then classic Walt Disney style gets bored and looks to the next project. And that's where he started planning this enormous, insane kind of utopian vision of the perfect planned city. And, you know, really left field, like, why is Walt Disney thinking about building a city? But up until that point, that's literally how all of his kind of innovative milestones had been seen as well. Like, why would you go from making, you know, shorts to a feature-length animated film? Why would you go from making animated films to a theme park? And then, you know, it goes on from there. So it was always this really interesting concept that just before he died, he was, you know, really in-depth planning a city with sophisticated public transport, modern housing with levels of affordability, plenty of leisure, recreation opportunities, schooling, like the ultimate in this American optimism vision of the future. And of course, it never happened. It absolutely never happened because he died in 1966. And this company that he left behind was like, we do not feel comfortable building a city without our fearless leader because we actually don't really care. It was really his kind of thing. And he's gone now. So we're just going to carry on doing what we know. And it's like, fair enough, to be honest. No one blames them for that.
It emphasizes a fact about Disney that is often quite hard to get your head around, which is obviously looking at the company now as being a massive, you know, it's a massive corporation making money and you know, adhering to the needs of shareholders is of tremendous importance to them. But when you look at a subject like either working towards the first animated feature or then working in towards Disneyland or then working in towards Epcot, how much money is not important to Walt Disney as anything other than a means to an end of going, that thing of like, I make money in order to make the next thing. I don't make money in order to, you know, obviously he was very wealthy. Obviously he, you know, enjoyed the privileges of being, the head of a major company and a cultural icon, but it was always, well, what else can I do next? Like to create Disneyland wasn't about making money as a priority. It was about creating, you know, creating a living film. With Epcot, it seems from looking up about it, it was about a kind of utopian ideal of what a society should be as dictated by Walter Elias Disney.
Absolutely. And there's some very compelling arguments on the more cynical side, which suggests that Epcot as a concept for a city is actually a really great example of it's probably for the best that unfortunately he did pass when he did, because it really could have turned out to be an absolute disaster. You know, there's not that many examples of incredible utopian planned cities around the world. You know, how old is Canberra? And it still feels like a ghost town. Shout out to Canberra. We love you, Canberra. But honestly, like, so, you know, there's always that fascinating thing about maybe it's best that it never happened and we can just, you know, think about what could have been. However, you know, going back to why I said to you, I think it would be a great topic is because I'm not a professor of Epcot as a concept, but I do feel very strongly and have an enormous passion for what we have today, which is Epcot, the theme park, which opened in the early 80s and was born out of essentially Disney having Walt Disney World in Florida, which was always the sequel to Disneyland, however, on this much grander scale. So, you know, there's various comparisons out there, but the size of Walt Disney World, for perspective, is sometimes compared to the island of Manhattan, sometimes Greater Manchester in the UK, which is really random, but it's big. So Walt Disney World is big. And for comparison's sake, Disneyland in California is literally just like two big blocks of land, which very quickly, as after it opened, became surrounded by hotels and restaurants and kind of carnage, which Walt Disney wanted to completely avoid in Florida. So there's all of these companies set up in Disney's name, which effectively own the land completely, giving them complete creative control over what was really just swamp, but has since become kind of like the biggest, you know, tourist destination on the planet. So I'm rambling a little bit here, but they open with the Magic Kingdom, which was like Disneyland's sequel. It's a castle park. It's like Disneyland on a grander scale. Everything's kind of bigger or flashier. People like to compare, like Disney fans like to compare and pick sides, Disneyland or, you know, the Magic Kingdom, a bit like in Australia, how you have to be Team Melbourne or Sydney. And in both cases, I'm like, guys, I just like them all. All right, I'm going to stay here. With Walt Disney World, you ended up with the Magic Kingdom opening in 1971, which was the final project oversaw by Walt's brother, Roy O. Disney. He sadly died after it opened. And then they kind of went through the 70s up to the early 80s, and they were like, well, you know, Walt Disney World is going gangbusters. We should open a second park because, hey, we've got the space. And that's when they kind of reverted back to this concept, this idea of this futuristic, permanent World's Fair location where kind of like the peak of human achievement could be celebrated. So the very best of technology, the forefront of innovation. Well, you know, for a while, some people wanted to focus on that tech aspect. And then other people thought, well, it should be more about, you know, bringing the world to Americans. So creating this permanent World's Fair where Americans could go and experience culture from around the world, which is, you know, kind of the most American thing I've ever heard of. You come to us rather than we come to you, but that's for another time. And the lore goes that, you know, the Imagineers who were building out the park, someone pushed these two models together in the workshop, one of the kind of futuristic park and one of the countries from around the world. And that is literally what the park became and is today. It's this kind of figure eight shape with these two parts smushed together. And it shouldn't work, but it absolutely works. So you enter the park and the first kind of the bottom of the figure eight is various pavilions and areas which celebrate different aspects of technology and the world and human achievement. And then you kind of go to the middle bend and you go out and around this huge lagoon are different pavilions based on countries around the world. So, you know, you'd walk through Mexico and Germany and Italy and China and Japan and the United Kingdom and Canada. And I guess back then the idea was, well, Americans could basically walk around a lagoon and feel like they've traveled around the world. And it worked.
So it kind of sounds a little bit as if it's a combination of the concept of Tomorrowland, which is over at Disneyland, and the World's Fair movement. Because I mean, I guess for listeners who don't know, the concept of World Fairs have kind of fallen away. But I mean, the idea of like this semi-annual event where you would bring all the technologies from, you know, different technological advances and research and ideas and from all over the world into these kind of single compounds that would be designed and built over many, many years so that people could see what the technology of the future might look like. I mean, it would have, you know, it's kind of a follow-on from the grand exhibitions that were occurring in the late 1800s in Europe that then traveled over around the world. But that kind of sounds like what Epcot has become. As opposed to a futuristic city, it has become more of a thing of a Tomorrowland-style theme park combined with the principles of a World's Fair, where it's about always looking forward, but that concept of looking forward always in a process of change.
Absolutely, exactly. And again, the kind of double-edged sword of cynicism and sentimentality comes out because in a park which is based on, you know, the very best of humans and the very best of what humans can do when, you know, we work together and we apply ourselves and we work hard and, you know, you can't help but walk around and like feel inspired. It's an inspiring place to be. You know, you walk through the countries and of course it's incredibly twee and, you know, cringe. And I say that as literally someone who worked at Epcot, but you know, the United Kingdom Pavilion is, you know, there's like a replica of Hampton Court. And I worked in like a kind of ye olde English pub, and it's very eye roll, but it's also a lot of fun and it's beautiful and it's artistic. Yeah, I guess going back to the Tomorrowland-esque aspect of it all, that would, like Tomorrowland, be Epcot's kind of eventual downfall on the futuristic side of it, because as this huge commercial behemoth, which was there to make money, it costs a lot of money to remain innovative, and it costs a lot of money to remain on the forefront of technology. So kind of in the early 90s was when they started to move around from trying to be at the very cutting edge, because it was kind of impossible or incredibly expensive. And that's where they moved away from, they coined this term like edutainment, where it would be entertaining but educational. And it kind of worked. I remember, you know, there'd be a lot of really weird wacko rides I'd go on as a kid, and I'd be like, this is bizarre, but kind of fun. And I feel like I'm learning. But they would then try and kind of focus on more, you know, thrill rides, which were, of course, you know, a mainstay of theme parks. And that's kind of led them through to today, where they include more Disney characters and IP. And that's because that's what people respond to. So they've slightly moved away from that original hardcore vision, for better or for worse. But it's still, you know, fairly similar to how it opened in its mission.
What has been your personal experience with it? Because you've both been there as a visitor and as, you know, and as an employee. What is your personal experience with Epcot?
So I guess this goes back to, you know, how like Disney seemingly has like dominated my entire life. I guess I was just really, really lucky and now incredibly grateful to have been part of a family where, you know, my mum and dad, they'd work really hard, and by no means were these holidays cheap. But from about the age of 9, it felt like we would go on trips to the States almost like every other year. And at the time, I even remember being this like, you know, that was just the coolest, most phenomenal thing. And we definitely wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be this kind of lavish, crazy holiday. We'd do it on the cheap. We'd stay in kind of like motels outside of Disney World and that kind of thing. But, you know, if that meant that we could visit more, I just had the absolute most amazing time going on these holidays to Disney World and around Florida and different parts of the States. So I just have these crystallized, incredible childhood memories of going to Disney World, going to Epcot, going to the Magic Kingdom, and just my very, very best childhood holiday memories were formed there. And it was the best. I actually, you know, I'm not going to look at it completely through rose-tinted glasses. The funny thing about Epcot is it's not a kids' park. So there's 4 theme parks in Disney World now. There's the Magic Kingdom, Epcot. There's Hollywood Studios, which used to be known as Disney MGM Studios. And then there's the Animal Kingdom. And they're all quite different, but Epcot is not the one that kids, you know, find the most enjoyment at. But the flip side of that is, it's the adults park. It's the Disney park for adults. Often when I tell people it was the Disney park for adults, they'd be like, well, are there like strip shows there? Is there porn? I'm like, no, you've gone a bit too far. But there's alcohol, and there's incredible food, and there's amazing entertainment, and there's really cool rides, which aren't full of, you know, Mickey Mouse. It was the park that I possibly least appreciated as a young visitor and probably most appreciate now. And I think the eternal link between Disneyland and then the jump forward to Epcot is that both of them, there had been nothing like them before they were opened. Now you've got Disneylands all over the world and you've got copies of Disneyland. But actually to this day, there's still nothing like Epcot. And that I've been thinking a lot today and yesterday, like preparing for this chat with you, thinking, why is it that I'm obsessed with this bonkers weird place? And it's precisely because it's weird and bonkers. It's an oddity. It should never have been opened. It was based, it's a theme park based on kind of like a science museum and countries from around the world with a lake in the middle, which was based on, by that point, a 20-year-old concept dreamed up by the company's founder to open a utopian city, which was never going to happen. But it did open. And it wasn't even like it attracted a niche audience. It was always incredibly popular. I think until very recently, it was always the second most visited Disney World park, and then it dropped down to third just a couple of years ago, and people were horrified. But still, like, incredibly popular. It touches a niche with people. It touches a nerve. But if you know, someone pitched a theme park based on what Epcot is built on today, it would never be made. And I think that's probably where my massive soft spot mainly comes from for it.
I mean, I have to be honest, the more that I've listening to you talk about the place as an actual entity, but also having read about the concepts behind it, it doesn't sound like a place that could possibly exist. It's like, I mean, it's the idea of combining education and entertainment is not a new idea. It's certainly an ideal that is kind of written throughout the history of Walt Disney Productions into the Walt Disney Company, certainly with all their television stuff. That was a big part of what, you know, they were pushing forward when they started launching into television, but not at this scale. I mean, it sounds like science fiction. I mean, Walt's original concept for Epcot sounds like science fiction. It sounds like the balance between a utopian or dystopian future. But even the idea of, like, you know, I look at images of Epcot and I read descriptions of Epcot and I just go, I don't understand how this works. I don't understand how this is viable as a business decision. I don't understand why they thought it was viable as a business decision at the time. And I guess maybe I imagine it's incongruity that makes it fascinating to visit and makes it appealing to people. Because, I mean, also, you know, as time's gone on, Epcot has grown as an urban legend in, you know, our understanding of, like, what it's Walt Disney's futuristic city. And so you want, if when you see the word Epcot, I imagine a lot of people are like, well, I want to go and see what that park looks like, because maybe I'll get a vision into what it was that he meant, what this madman had in his mind when he was conceiving this right up until he died. It sounds too bizarre to possibly exist, which I guess is probably more than reason for it to exist. But what was it like working there? What was it like to actually be part of that?
So, you know, kind of skipping forward a few years later, I remember being there, like, on holiday. And, you know, if you've ever been to a Disney park anywhere in the world, the cast members who work there would have their name tags with the hometown that they've come from on the name tag. So it would be Joey from Orlando or whatever. And I remember walking through the World Showcase and for the first time clocking the hometowns of people on their name tags and walking through the United Kingdom Pavilion. I remember speaking to a girl. I don't remember her name. Shout out to unknown girl. I hope you're living a very happy life. But she had on her name tag Leeds, UK. And my mind was blown because I just assumed that everyone who worked in Disney World was American. And I remember saying to her, why are you here? How did you get here? And she was like, well, you know, there's just this program where Disney kind of ship people from all over the world to work in these pavilions in World Showcase as part of, you know, making it more authentic. And, you know, just research. I don't think she said Google. I don't know if we would have had Google then, but I don't know if it would have been a verb like it is now. She told me kind of how to get more information on it. And I think I was maybe 15 or 16, but I just knew that was absolutely what I was going to do when I left university. I just knew it was just, like, formed in my mind. So I got off to university in Manchester from the ages of, you know, 19 to 21 or whatever, had an incredible time. And as many queer people find, when you go to university, you know, life begins and you kind of really, you know, start to find yourself. And I kind of forgot about this, you know, teenage obsession I had with Disney. It just was not a priority. As time, you know, kind of went on and I was thinking about what I was going to do after university, I remembered that I had this idea and I Googled it. And it all came up, and it was an agency in the UK which Disney contracted to organize this. And I guess that's another part of that insane attention to detail that they would go to this effort to achieve this level of immersion, which you just can't fault, which is Disney worked with the US government when they opened Epcot in the early 80s to negotiate a new category of visa, which would allow them to bring international workers from around the world for the sole purpose of improving the immersion and cultural awareness of being in Disney theme parks, which is bonkers. And it's still in place. And one of my favorite things is they import Australians over to be lifeguards in the hotels. So that's the job that you guys get.
The one thing we're good at, water and sports combined.
Yeah. I remember going through the interview process. The interviews were in Disney's European headquarters in London and making my way through. And it was, I started to meet, you know, these people who are also applying, who, and many of them are absolutely some of my best friends on the planet now. It was such an incredible experience, which shaped us. And the date was set. I ended up graduating from uni in the May, and in July I was on a plane to Orlando. So I ended up there. I think I was, still 21 then. And I still had remnants of bleach blonde peroxide in my hair, which is a massive Disney no-no. And I remember trying to convince this lady that, you know, it was just my natural hair. And she just kind of stared at me. And I knew that she knew I was lying, but I don't think she could be bothered that day. So she just moved on. But it was all of a sudden absolutely bizarre to be, training and unlearning to work in a place where I had all these magical childhood memories, but was actually now my place of work. And not only a place of work, but, you know, it was as gap year place of work as it gets. We were all of these British early 20s, wild children who had come to Disney World to work in a restaurant and a pub and just have the absolute best time. And that we did. So my life in Disney for that year was not very Disney. It was, rocking up to work, incredibly hungover. And, so the restaurant that I worked in was called The Rose and Crown, this ye olde English pub. And it was one of the very few restaurants in Epcot which was actually on the lagoon. And in the middle of the lagoon, every single night, they'd have this insane fireworks display called Illuminations. It was really one of the most amazing fireworks shows that you'd ever see. And because we had like tables on the lower deck by the water, they were like really high in demand because you'd want to go there and have your dinner and, you know, watch the fireworks. But every morning it meant that you had to go and wipe down the fireworks ash from the table before the new guests of the day arrived. And I've just got these memories of wiping down these tables with this pounding hangover. But then you'd get through the day and you'd be serving all of these tourists from all over the world. And actually just having so much fun. And you'd finish up the day and these incredible fireworks would go off in front of you. And once you've seen that fireworks show, 200 times, the effect does wear off. But for that, for that once in a lifetime family who've saved up all that money to go to Disney World and see that fireworks show, that was just the most magical experience. And we would be witness to that every night. And for me, I don't think it ever really completely got old. There'd be many times where I'd be like, okay, fireworks are on now. We need to clock out because we need to get home, have a shower, jump in a taxi, drive down the I-4, go to the drag show, get lit, get a McDonald's on the way home, go to bed, do it all over again. Hello, people, don't judge me. I was 21 years old and would do it all again in a heartbeat. But we were in the most magical place on earth. And I look at it now as absolutely one of the best years of my life. It was so formative. I can't help but think about it and not just smile. It was amazing. And so I have these very specific versions of Epcot. I have the Epcot where I'd explore as a teenager, where I'd start learning about like the Imagineers, like who were these amazing people who built this park? Where did it come from? Like, why is it so quirky and weird? Wow, that was a cool ride. And then I have the Epcot where I worked at, which was literally the day, the place where I'd get the bus to and from every day. And, you know, the staff canteen was a Subway. So, you know, after having Subway for every day for a year, you really don't want Subway ever again. But was just a really cool place to work. Like, so much fun. The people, the place, everything. And now I have the Epcot of, I've only ever been back to visit once since working there, because after leaving the US, I kind of ended up in Australia, which is where I've been ever since. And as you would know, Daniel, Australia is just really hard to get from to anywhere in the world. So I've only made it back to the States once.
Yes, very.
And it was on a family holiday a few years ago. And it was a big family reunion. And my sister came, and my sister had never come with us on those earlier trips. And she was really excited to come now and see this place, which I'd worked at. She was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see it. And this is where, you know, again, the tension between being cynical and sentimental comes out in me. I am like hyperventilating at the thought of going back to this place where I had like the best year of my life. And I'm like, I'm walking to the Rose and Crown pub, and you know, you have this flashback of every single memory you made in that place going through your brain, and all of the laughter and the tears and the frustration and the happiness. And I walk into the pub, you know, just expecting to have this incredible magical experience. And my sister's like, oh yeah, I mean, it's all right, isn't it? It's just like a pub though. And I'm like, excuse me, this was where I had the best year of my life. And it's like, yeah, but it is just a pub. So, and that is my constant kind of, that summarizes what I was trying to say at the start. You know, Disney, the theme parks, the films, they are these incredibly magical, amazing, emotional entities to us, but they're also just a theme park. They're also just a film. And I think it's that, that line that we toe, which is also part of the enjoyment. And gosh, I've just gone on for quite some time. Is that, are you still with us, listeners? Is anyone still with us?
Of course they are. They're listening with bated breaths at this beautiful description of this beautiful experience. But to kind of bounce off that, I guess one question I do want to ask from your experience of both having visited Epcot and then worked at Epcot, what was the biggest surprise that you had in that transition? What was the thing when you were working there that surprised you the most about the way that Epcot is run, the philosophy behind Epcot, the development of Epcot while you were present there? What was something that when you actually got to work there and pulled the curtain back to see the way that that particular park functioned, what surprised you the most?
Well, when one pulls the curtain back, they do wonder, what one wonders, will I ever have a future career with the Walt Disney Company? Because that might dictate what I say. However, I would
imagine that would on your mind, yes.
But also, is that a little bit delusional? I don't know. No, I think what the story I'd like to tell, you know, current employees of Disney have said worse things. It's just little things like, you know, you'd be in this theme park, which had cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and you walk around just in awe of the level of quality and the attention to detail and no stone left unturned. But then you'd be working in what operationally was literally just a restaurant. As my sister said, it's just a pub. And, you know, sometimes as a waiter there, you wouldn't be able to find paper napkins. And you'd go to your manager and you'd be like, we're out of napkins. And they'd be like, well, we didn't get a delivery. And I'm like, in seconds, I could just Google how much this company is making in profits each year. How do we not have paper napkins? So that was just one part of it. A really interesting other part of it, though, was, as you know, an Imagineering Disney theme park nerd, I remember having this the kind of morning meeting where your manager tells you what's happening that day, how many reservations there are and things like that. I don't remember exactly what. It was almost like there was one door in and out of the lower deck to the restaurant, which was just notorious for people bumping into each other. Like, it was just really hard to see who was coming. And I remember making this flippant comment like, can't, you know, Disney literally just build a new door so we don't crash into each other? And my manager looked at me completely seriously and said, do you know what process I'd have to go through to request that door is amended? I'd be like, no, tell me. And she was like, I would legitimately have to put forward a business case to my manager, to their manager, to their manager, which gets submitted to Walt Disney Imagineering in California, who would then come back with a fee that this restaurant would have to pay out of our, you know, OPEX budget or whatever, just to get that door fixed. And in that sense, it's this fascinating insight into the business behind the art, which is what we talked about at the start, which is it's such a beautiful place to be in, created by these incredible artists, but you do not get to be a company of Disney's financial size and weight by not, you know, counting every single penny. And it's in just such conflict to the Disney that we want to know. We want to know, we want to be immersed in the beautiful, fun, elegant, incredible side of it. We don't want to talk about penny pinching and invoicing and things like that. But in that moment, I was like, this really is just, you know, it's not always the Magic Kingdom. Sometimes it's actually just an American corporate entity.
I mean, that links into one of the things that was kind of like the downfall of Walt's concept of Epcot as this kind of utopian city, and was quite a surprise, both a surprise initially to read, was the fact, like, but then kind of makes a lot of sense considering what we know about him, was the idea that if you lived in Epcot, you had no autonomy. Like, there was no government body, you had no voting rights, you had no say. Like, the idea of, like, you know, we can come into your house and replace the appliances with new appliances that we want to test at a moment's notice, whether you like it or not, and you're essentially signing away your right to say no to that. And that the only person who can make any major decisions, all decisions must be made by Walt Disney himself. I mean, we understand that, you know, in his 60s, that is the decision he comes to. He builds this utopian studio, like studio for his artists. They revolt, they go on strike. It's not good enough for them. He goes to build this utopian theme park, you know, in order to have complete control of everything. There are some things he just can't have control over. And that sense of wanting to have complete control seems to be endemic in all of the decisions that Walt Disney was making, right down to his ultimate vision, which was this futuristic city where we could test out technology and there'd be no slums and then cars wouldn't be a problem and, you know, waste would be dealt with and all of those issues that, you know, we associate with urban planning now in a major city would not exist, which sounds lovely, but all dictated by the decisions of one man. And that seems to now be endemic from listening to that story and other stories we know about Disney. That now seems to be endemic of Disney, of the Walt Disney Company itself, of the idea of, you know, in order to have these amazing worlds, there has to be complete control. You know, that means you don't see, trash on the ground in Disneyland or Walt Disney World. It means that, you know, quality is maintained at every stage. That's an amazing concept and also a terrifying concept, like that degree of environmental control. And it's amazing considering that, you know, animation in itself is about the process of control, because obviously every single thing you see on screen is decided upon, even more so than it would be if a live action film. And live action film, you know, for want of a better phrase, God is part of the equation when it comes to live action. With animation, they're not. In animation, it's complete control. But there's a certain degree of spontaneity, there's a certain degree of imagination, there's trying things and testing things, and, you know, it's kind of a beautiful free fall that can come with animation. With the parks, that doesn't seem to be a factor. You have to have the right hair. You have to have the right door. There's a process you have to go through. And, like, even down to, you know, the idea of, you know, you can work in a place like Disney World or Disneyland or Epcot, but you still have to pay enormous amounts of money for the privilege to both be there and to work there. The degree of control that, you know, Walt had imbued in the company that has now become part of the culture of the company is kind of incredible, in a similar way to the way that Steve Jobs had done with Apple, I suppose, but maybe to an even greater degree, because Steve Jobs was just conceiving of shifting the world as it existed now. Walt Disney was conceiving of a world that was completely different of the world that we have now. To kind of finish off after my little tirade, to kind of finish off on one last question I wanted to ask, do you think Epcot as a concept, both either the concept that Walt Disney had before his death in 1966 or the concept of what Epcot is now, maybe more that so, I guess, because that's something that's actually tangible. Does Epcot still have a place? Do you think that a park, a complex, an idea like that of the idea of combining education and entertainment on that scale, aimed much more towards an adult audience than necessarily a child audience, do you think that still has a place now? Because technology has changed, communication has changed, so much has changed since 1982. Where do you think Epcot still has a place in the world?
Of course, I'm going to say abso-friggin-lutely, because if Epcot didn't exist, where would I go on holiday and get my margaritas when I'm in Mexico and then go back to Germany and get a beer and pretzel? But, you know, I'm going to fully remove the cynic hat and just completely stay focused in the sentimentality lane here, but try and have some ration and reason about it. The power that Disney has in attracting these vast, enormous audiences, you know, Walt Disney World pre-COVID, I think was maybe the most visited tourist attraction on the planet, if not the country of, I think the country of France is number one and Disney World is number two. Who's going to France? Hello. Shout out to France. We love you, France. But
well, they also have their own Disneyland. So, I mean, they do have that slight advantage. They both have the country of France and also a Disneyland in there as well.
They do. And I love Disneyland Paris, but that's a whole other episode. I feel like the amount of people who go through those turnstiles is so vast and enormous that a company has the capacity to still in this incredibly cynical time period where it feels like we, but especially Americans, have never been more divided or opposed with each other, that we could still immerse people for just one day in experiences which celebrate the very best of human achievement. And it's incredibly hard to do that and would absolutely cost a lot of money. And is the modern Disney company willing to spend that level of money and upkeep on making it continually this place? I don't know. But in the last 10, 15, 20 years, they've tried very hard to make their experiences more timeless because, you know, it's too expensive to keep, you know, remaking them. But also, there are a lot of positives to more timeless and less of the moment experiences. They recently announced, just to, actually, sadly, again, way before COVID, and then a lot of it got canned during COVID, a whole, you know, wave of renovations and refurbishment intended at making Epcot more relevant for the long term. So yes, that brings what some people see as negatives, like more Disney characters, more IP, you know, these immaculate World Showcase pavilions are now filled with a Ratatouille ride in the France pavilion. And there was going to be a Mary Poppins ride in the UK, but that got canned for COVID. There's a Frozen ride in Norway. Frozen actually isn't even set in Norway, but there I'm splitting hairs, I know. But if that's what gets people through the door, you know, that Frozen ride, when it opened, fans were like, how dare you open a Frozen ride in this, you know, sacred Epcot. But when that ride opened, it would have waits of 4 to 6 hours full of families whose little girls and boys just wanted to go on the Frozen ride. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing, because on that day in Epcot, they might go on the Frozen ride, but then they might go to, you know, the exhibit on the Living Seas and see all of the incredible aquamarine life, which they may not see otherwise. They might go to the Land Pavilion, which teaches people how farming happens and has this corny but very effective, just ask my mother, video using the Lion King characters on why we should all recycle. Honestly, I kid you not, my mum, this would buy so many crates of bottled water, and I remember her leaving that Lion King show and being like, I'm not going to buy it anymore. I'm not going to buy bottled water. I mean, I need to check in with Trish whether she's still kept that up. But, you know, all jokes aside, I think that there is power in this massive corporate entity attracting all of these people and exposing them to things which maybe otherwise they wouldn't be exposed to. But it does take commitment. It takes artistic integrity, and it also takes a lot of money. So I definitely think there's a place for Epcot, but it needs to have some very strong-willed custodians with deep pockets, which at the minute, even though, you know, COVID has its ups and downs and Disney as a company has its ups and downs, there's a lot of people who still work at Disney and Imagineering who care incredibly deeply about Epcot and have a lot of reverence for it and where it came from. So it's not necessarily a concern there.
And I mean, it's the ideal of the collision between the symbiosis of education and entertainment is a, you know, for people working in an artistic field, it's kind of a to bounce off the concept of it, it's a kind of a utopian ideal. And there is an audience for it. I mean, I worked for a number of years at Melbourne Museum, and one of the things that surprised me was that the amount that families were far more drawn to a traditional museum style of exhibition than they were to something a bit more technologically interesting or something that kind of, you know, was a bit more dealing with the exhibition form. And that there is actually a really strong need and desire for families to go to a place where they can be educated in a fun and interesting way. And you're completely right. Yes, they can wait for 4 to 6 hours for a Frozen ride, but they're also in a compound that has educational possibilities to it. And that all, you know, if those educational possibilities are present and those educational possibilities are still dynamic and interesting, they may go there and they may have their life changed slightly. They may be able to go and see the world in a different perspective. And certainly, you know, the world is now a very different place. It's going to be much harder for us to be able to travel around for a while, certainly with, you know, the unknown of what this thing we're living with is going to do. The idea of a place that you can go to that's safe, that's controlled, that can expose you to cultures from around the world, hopefully in a, you know, sensitive, intelligent, open manner. But the idea of that being a possibility for children is probably a very exciting one and a really important one. You've made me start to see Epcot as an actual thing now from listening to you talk about it. It seems like a discernible thing that actually has a purpose.
I'm glad that it had that impact. And it makes me think of also, you know, my partner comes from a family where to go on a family holiday to a theme park was unthinkable. And there's many, many, many families out there like that. And I get it, right? You know, why would you want to go to many theme parks, which are just, you know, kind of fairgrounds or, you know, dodgy roller coasters? Or why would you spend your money there when you could go to a fabulous city and have expose your children to wonderful cultural opportunities? So it makes sense. But when we went to Japan for a holiday a couple of years ago, I said to Tom, like, I really want you to come to a Disney park with me in Tokyo. And he was very open to it the whole time. He wasn't really ever opposed to it, but he was like, I just don't know why we'd come to Japan and spend our day in a theme park. And I'm like, I get it, but just trust me on this, because I know that Tom, having a massive interest in things like architecture and the arts and music and performance, I knew that once he and like anyone who would, you know, have these preconceptions of a Disney park, once you spend a day there and you've been immersed in it, you see that it just really is so much more than a theme park. You know, even if it is the same roller coaster that you could go to on the Gold Coast, this roller coaster is inside a volcano which spits fire and, you know, has had artisans chipping away at fake rock, which, yes, it's all fake, but it's incredible. These people have built worlds, and they've built worlds with a massive stack of money behind them, and money makes amazing things happen. And I guess the reason that just popped into my head is because I think about, you know, you, Daniel, you have this enormous passion for Disney, and you say that up until this point you haven't been to a Disney park. But I just know, I mean, I'm kind of already annoyed for something which hasn't happened yet, which is the likelihood that I won't be with you on your first day in a Disney park. And I just feel like you will have the best time. You're going to have to take spare sets of underwear. You're going to have regular breaks where you just sit down and just, you know, maybe do some mindfulness, because otherwise you are going to have a heart attack, and it's all in your future.
I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry the whole time. Like, I'm determined that, you know, if anyone's like, you know, which one do you want to go to? So like, I want to go to Disneyland. I want to go to the original one. I'm sure I want to go to all the other ones as well, but I want to start by going there. And I'm sure, you know, Alex, the producer of Incompate, and I have talked about, like, that it's going to be the thing we do at the end of this. If we get to the end of this insane project, we're going to celebrate by going to Disneyland. So actually, it's likely that you'll be able to I'm sure Alex will have some sort of recorder where he's like, tell me what you think, what are you thinking, how are you feeling? And I'll probably just be having a breakdown the whole time. I'm sure everyone will hear when I finally go to a park. I mean, yeah, because you know, it's a thing that my mum wanted to do when we were kids. She still wants to do that. She still talks about, one day I want to go to Disneyland. It means she has to go on a plane and travel overseas. But, you know, there is something deeply appealing about the idea of going, again, stepping into the mind of this cultural entity that now dominates so many aspects of our cultural lives.
And maybe you'll be able to recreate that wonderful photo of Howard Ashman standing outside the gates at Disneyland on his first trip there in the 70s. That would be really cute.
If only. Hopefully. That'll be my aim. To ask the last question that we ask on Ink and Paint, I mean, you've already answered this question, but I'd want to give you a chance to expand on it a bit more. What is your favorite Disney animated film?
Can I derail this slightly? I know you ask it because I've heard many episodes and I love people's answers. But because we've spoken about Beauty and the Beast, because we've done an entire episode on another podcast on Little Mermaid, which would be my other one, we've also kind of touched on Pocahontas. I'm going to try and keep with this theme, and I'm going to tell you about my favorite Disney theme park, because it's not Epcot.
Sure, go for it. Go for it.
So my favorite Disney theme park on the planet is Tokyo DisneySea, which is up there with Epcot and the original Disneyland in how completely, utterly bonkers and unique and, you know, against all odds it is in its conception and execution. It was created because the Japanese opened Tokyo Disneyland in the 80s, literally, I think, a year after Epcot opened. And Tokyo Disneyland was the first overseas park. And it was kind of a hybrid of both Disneyland in California and the Magic Kingdom in Florida. The Japanese kind of picked their favorites of both parks. And the Imagineers were like, okay, well, we did it, so here you go. And it's a great park, but it's kind of been done before. Now, 20 years later, the Japanese were like, well, Disney's opening other parks around the world, and that's great, but we want something that only we have. We want, you know, something which is in no other countries and never will be. And the reason I keep saying the Japanese is because Tokyo Disney Resort is owned It's actually the only Disney resort which is not owned at all by Disney. It's owned by a Japanese company, the Oriental Land Company. And they basically have this exclusive agreement with Disney where anything that they want to do in the parks, they have to contract the Imagineers. You know, they of course have to give a percentage of their profits every year to Disney, but they own the park. And what that means is, because they have a mission to be different from any other Disney resort, and they have to use the Disney Imagineers, the level of quality is mind-boggling because they get the very best. So they said back in the early 2000s, we want a park which is just ours and unlike any other. And the Imagineers had this concept for basically an aquatic version of Disneyland, hence the name Tokyo Disney Sea. And it's various lands and areas, and there's, you know, a water theme to all of them. But I just cannot express how unique and bizarre and over the top and incredible it is. And there's in all of their theme parks around the world, they've got many Disneylands, they've got a couple of studio type parks, but the three most unique groundbreaking parks are Disneyland, Epcot, and Tokyo Disney Sea. So you, Daniel, I get it. You want to start at Disneyland and I know why, but you've got to make it to all three of them. And I want to report back in full when you've done it.
I mean, I just need to go because you've made Epcot feel like it's a thing that I can comprehend now. I cannot comprehend what the fuck that would be like. Now I have to go just to be able to be like, what even is that? What even does that mean? Disney Sea? What does that even mean? I don't want you to tell me. I don't want you to tell me at all because I want to just be surprised when I finally do go, because going to Tokyo and going to Japan is definitely something I want to do. One, and I imagine I will just have to go to Disneyland Tokyo because it's there. But yeah, now you've thrown my whole world into a spin again. It's like, what the fuck is that? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What is all this? Anyway, I will report back to you when I finally go, one day when the world opens up. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on In Campaign. Thank you so much for sharing your passion and your insight and your knowledge of this very strange but very important aspect of Disney history. And in some ways, adjacent, an important part of the history of Disney animation, in the sense of, you know, where did Disney's level of control go? It went into this, and then it morphed into something new, a new thing that exists in the world. So thank you so much for joining us here on Ink and Paint.
Absolutely. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks for listening to this in-betweener bonus episode on Walt Disney's futuristic city, Epcot, and the Epcot Center at Walt Disney World. Thank you also to Andy for joining me on this episode. You can find out more information about his terrific podcast with co-host Drew at oralfixationpodcast.com. And you can find episodes of Oral Fixation on all your favorite podcasting platforms. They've got some amazing guests talking about some of the great queer music of our time, including yours truly, talking with Andy and Drew about the work of Howard Ashman. You can also check out the show notes on this in-betweener at inkandpaint.com.au, including links to the full versions of the CalArts story and Walt's Florida Project report. You can follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at inkpaintpod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. You can also email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. A big thank you to all our listeners supporting us on Patreon. If you'd like to support the podcast and have access to exclusive bonus content, be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/inkpaintpod. We'll be releasing new in-betweeners as we go along, so make sure to follow Ink and Paint on your favourite podcasting platform to make sure you don't miss any. If you enjoyed this episode, please also remember to rate and review and to tell your friends about us. Ink and Paint in-betweeners were created, hosted and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.